This is Nicholas Eisengruber on behalf of Wayne State University and the Walter P. Reuther Library, interviewing Dr. Paul Benson on his time and work with HIV and its place within the larger LGBTQ community.
Dr. Benson is a recognized individual within the HIV medical community. Besides owning his own private practice in Berkeley, Michigan, Dr. Benson is also an assistant clinical professor at Michigan State University in the College of Osteopathic Medicine. He has been on numerous committees and research groups over the last 37 years, all designed to help find a cure for HIV and create better lives for those afflicted with the virus. Dr. Benson continues to research in hopes of ultimately finding a cure for HIV in his lifetime. Now at the tail end of his illustrious career, the many people Dr. Benson has treated throughout the years are a testament to his kindness and generosity, especially in the face of HIV, which has ravaged the LGBTQ community for decades. Dr. Benson has had many trials and tribulations throughout his time as a medical professional. Talking with him has been a fascinating insight into not only the early days of HIV prevention and treatment, but how that compares to the treatment HIV-positive people receive today.
So, my first question, just for you as a doctor, why did you decide to pursue medicine in the first place?
I always wanted to be in a people-helping profession since junior high school on up, so I was pretty well focused. I was a hardworking student through undergraduate, high school, etc., you know, to reach my goal of being a physician, which I am. I never planned on being an HIV specialist. I never planned on being a gay physician specializing in the gay and transgender community. It kind of fell upon me. I always wanted to be a Marcus Welby type family doctor. I knew I always wanted primary care family medicine, and I was looking forward to take care of families and kids and watching them grow old and that kind of stuff. But 1980, when I finished my residency, a new syndrome of HIV, it was called GRID at that time, came out. And I found patients starting to come to me, some friends, and I heard lots of horror stories of people going to certain doctors that would come in wearing gloves and gowns and refusing to see them, and hospitals refusing to see an HIV patient, including my own at the beginning. And it kind of found me that all of a sudden lots of people were coming to me with HIV, a lot of my friends. It was a very, very different time back in the 1980s. And it clearly changed my life. It made me a much better physician and much more passionate, much more appreciative of life in general. In the old days, people would hide the fact that they were HIV positive. There were times that I'd have somebody in the hospital that passed away, and I'd have to call the family, and they weren't even aware that their kid was in the hospital. There's just a whole lot of fears and a whole lot of prejudices back then. It was a disease that when I came around, there was no medicines to treat it. We didn't even know it was a virus. And I felt a lot of times like a Dr. Kevorkian without the publicity, that many times it was really helping people just, you know, die with dignity and keep them out of pain. And then it was living from, you know, one Christmas to the next or one birthday to the next. Where now it's great. It's a chronic, manageable, easy disease. As easy as one pill once a day. And the focus for HIV nowadays is prevention and getting people tested to know their status. And if they're positive, get them treated. And I look forward to seeing eradication or the end of AIDS in my lifetime. And it's kind of neat that I came around at the beginning of the disease, right. And I still plan on being here when it's eradicated as well, God willing.
Hope so.
Yeah.
So you've been practicing since
1980. I opened myself private practice in the Monday after Thanksgiving in 1980.
Oh, well, there you go.
Yeah.
You became first aware of the HIV epidemic when?
In 1980, certainly in training, I didn't hear much about it.
So right when you started, basically?
Yeah, right when I started. Actually, there was a gay newspaper called Cruise Magazine at the time, And the editor of Cruise, editor and owner, Tony Rome, came to me and said, would you write a story on this grid? And being a young new physician, I said, yeah, I'd be happy to write a story and get published on something. But I really didn't know what grid was.
Sure.
So I, I did my research on it and, wrote that article. I wish I still have it. I don't have it in my files anymore. But that was probably my first, learning of grid. It was something silent people just didn't really talk about. And then before I knew it, I was like the community's expert on HIV.
Do you remember your initial thoughts about HIV at all? Like, you said you weren't aware that it was a virus right away. So.
I think, I always...
Or the medical profession.
Right, I always felt it was a virus because it behaved like a virus, but the virus wasn't identified at that time. I think my focus back in the 1980s and probably early in the 1990s was more on helping people deal with their sexuality and coming out and living with HIV. It's much different. We're not a perfect society now. There's still a lot of stigma, but it's nowhere near compared to what it was in the 1980s. And I never really considered myself an AIDS activist. I worked in the trenches and had relationships with people and helped them, but I wasn't really a big fighter for governmental change, and I wasn't part of ACT UP or anything like that. And back in those days, I don't want to say I disliked them, but I thought that it was not the way to go about and get changes.
Sure.
But now that I'm older, I really realize and appreciate that you need the activists and the pacifists.
Right.
And everybody works together in the circle of life to get it done.
So with so many at the beginning within your profession not treating the patients, or... you said they had the gloves and they...
Yes.
Why did you decide you would be treating them?
Because it started out that a number of these individuals were my friends.
Right.
So I did not have the stigma against gay people. I am gay.
Right.
Or HIV. So it was just like a natural fit. I wasn't going to turn my friends away and say, I can't help you. And then, then it started out being more than just friends, and friends were telling other friends, and there was very few people, maybe a couple doctors at Henry Ford and myself, and really that was it, at that period of time. May I also say that back at that period of time, I was a young man back then, I just finished residency, opened up my own private practice, and I wanted to be involved with the hospital and their teaching program. Back in those days, the students and the residents wanted nothing to do with me. They thought of me and my practice as being dirty and a place to stay away. And over the years, there's certainly been a metamorphosis of change, because now I have waiting lines of students and residents wanting to come in here. So that's like really nice to see.
That's good. So yeah, I guess you just did mention it. You experienced backlash from other professionals initially.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Even to a fact that at the time, a number of the physicians at the hospital were forming what's called a super group of a bunch of practices joining under one umbrella to get better buying power and a whole bunch of other things. And I was not invited to join into that group. And I only found out many years later, because I'm in that group now,
right,
that they didn't want me because of the patients that I was taking care of, and they thought it was too much of a financial risk for them to deal with that group of people.
So your professional reputation has certainly improved since those days.
Now, I'm like a local leading expert, and all the physicians in my hospital hold me in very high regard. And when they have HIV patients or problems or questions, or they get a needle poke, I'm one of the first ones that they call.
That's good. Do you think you would change any of the ways you... or a way you did things back then, back in the 80s, knowing the things you do now?
Oh, what a loaded question,
right,
is that. I think that I went to bed every night then and now knowing that I did the best that could be done, and I'm very, I don't want to sound arrogant, but I'm very proud of myself for that.
Sure.
Back at that time, Esther, I don't want, can you come back in a little bit?
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay.
Back at those times, there was a lot of infighting in the gay community. And it's still partially to this day, it still exists that a lot of community groups are in competition with each other, and we don't really work in harmony, as I see other communities in the United States and other places in the world as well do. We're not as bad now as we were back in the 80s and 90s, but that infighting that we had really served no good purpose.
Are there a lot of competing gay activist groups, or is there just one and there's a lot of infighting within that one group?
There's probably a few now. The patients back then to now are much different. Most of the patients back then were very, very angry. They were fighters. They were vocal. Now, because AIDS is a chronic, manageable, well-known disease, the patients are usually not that vocal or angry. A matter of fact, there's probably complacency about HIV now. So, I mean, yesterday I had a young man come in, a 21-year-old, that came in, and I was talking to him about his sexuality, and it's like, he is on PrEP, which is a good thing, but does not use condoms at all, has multiple partners, and it's like, this is my lifestyle, and I'm not going to wear condoms because it ruins intimacy. And I attempted to have a conversation about what I felt intimacy was, where intimacy is not necessarily the act of sex, it's having a close bond with the person. Mm-hmm. And he wanted nothing to hear of it. So he's a 21-year-old, I'm a 64-year-old, so I figured, you know what, I'm not going to be parental and start lecturing him because I'll probably never see him back again.
Right.
So, you know, so I just let it drop. But it's the complacency now compared to 20, 30 years ago, it's really not productive. And so I don't think we really see those activists for the HIV cause.
Right.
Of the young people. We still have a lot of the old timers that are, you know, very, very passionate and you know, and go around doing HIV education and prevention work. However, I'm concerned because as these old timers, these dinosaurs such as myself, are retiring, hopefully retiring and not dying, but choose whichever you want. As we leave practice, I don't see the new physicians and the new community activists with the passion that we had through those old days. And that's concerning to me. From a physician's point of view, being an HIV specialist is really not high on the profitable scale.
Mm-hmm.
In medicine, unless it changes, we get paid for doing procedures, and we really don't get paid much for using our mind and thinking. And when it comes to taking care of HIV patients, it's more mind type things. So a lot of young doctors coming out are not necessarily attracted to HIV care or primary care for that matter. They'd rather be specialists, which is more of a lucrative thing for them. So those things concern me. I don't know, 10 years from now, I don't know if regular family doctors are going to be taking care of HIV. I'm not sure how it's going to be, but certainly it's a specialty that's not flourishing. It's going away.
Do you think that's because there is daily, you said there was preventative treatments now? Do you think that's because it's not such an epidemic, or?
No, because there's still plenty to go around.
Sure.
It's not a
sure.
perfect world.
Sure.
The United States, we have about 50,000 new cases every year, so it's not going away. And patients now that are HIV positive are living a normal lifespan. So it used to be in the old days, people would not live long.
Mm-hmm.
and you get a new turnover. So we're getting new people entering the HIV system because they're positive, and people that are already positive are living longer. So HIV specialists are really as busy, if not busier now than we've ever been.
Oh, okay. So back in the 80s, did HIV patients know to seek you out? Like, how far was the reach that people would come to you, like out of state or anything like that?
I have a few out of state, but I still have some of my original patients. I have one gentleman that, am I being too verbose? Or
this no, is this okay. is good. This is
okay,
good.
Super. So I have one gentleman that I've been taking care of since around 1990. His name is Marty, and he comes to me from Jackson, Michigan. So it's a couple hour
sure.
drive.
Mm-hmm.
And I just saw him last summer, and he says, Doc, do you remember, you know, when I came to you when I was first diagnosed? And I said, geez, Marty, I said, it was a long time ago. I really don't. He says, do you remember who was with me at the time you diagnosed me? And I said, it must have been the boss. So it's kind of a little joke. His wife comes to a lot of his visits, and she's very concerned and loving of him, so I always call her the boss.
Sure.
He goes, yeah, he goes, the boss was with me, but there was somebody else too. I said, I'm sorry, Marty, I don't know who it is. He said, I had my new baby girl in the bassinet with me. And I said, well, I said, I believe you, but I really don't remember it. He says, do you remember when I asked you on that first visit? I don't, Marty. He said, I asked you, Doc, what's our goal living with HIV? And I said to him, our goal is that you live well long enough that you can walk your daughter down the aisle. And at that point, tears came in his eyes, and he brought out the photo book because his daughter just got married. And he gave me a picture of him walking his daughter down the aisle, which I still have in my folder here. And whenever I lecture on HIV, not all my lectures, but a lot of them,
mm-hmm.
I start out with that photograph and tell that story.
That's a great story.
It's very, very touching.
Do you think the people that were opposed to your practice back in the day, you think they were afraid of the disease, homophobic, a mix?
Mixed. There was a number of homophobic individuals. In the beginning, I had a lot of bisexual married men with HIV, and you can only imagine the tanglement that was of being HIV positive and having wife and kids. And I've seen every scenario to the wife being very, very supportive and staying with them to where they've thrown the guy out of the house and sued. And one case in particular, you know, the father lost custody of his kids. So I've seen every degree in between on that. But the social stigma of dealing with the HIV positivity and living with a life of HIV was certainly was much more difficult than it is now.
Mm-hmm. Do you touch any of the patients during that time? Like, I know people thought back then that it could be transferred by touch or by...
Absolutely.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Absolutely. I have been and always will be, although now with today's environment with touching, you never know.
Right, yeah.
You never know what's going to happen. But I've always been a very touching doctor. I've just learned that in my training. I like to put my hand on people's shoulder. If there's something going on very depressing, they're crying, I don't mind hugging my patients. I think that's part of the therapeutic healing power. I've always been that way, and I always will be. But sometimes people caution me on that. But I'm not doing it in a provocative
right.
way. And I kind of know my patients, and if I feel I need to distance from them, then I don't do that.
Mm-hmm.
But many of my patients I've taken care of for 20, 30 plus years, it's a non-issue.
Sure. Do you remember if your friends or family were concerned for your health specifically during this time?
Great question. My mom and dad were.
Mm-hmm.
When I first started practice, I was closeted. I was in the closet. My family did not know about my sexuality at all. And when they first started seeing that I was taking care of AIDS patients, my mom and dad had a lot of concerns about it. Not enough that it swayed me, not enough that they threatened me with anything or whatever, just loving concern, because back then it was a different world. You don't know how it was transmitted, et cetera.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And they were definitely concerned about my well-being and health. You know, and eventually, I mean, I won't get into too much of the detail, but that's how my sexuality came out to my family and how I opened up and everything on that.
Mm-hmm.
And my family was all loving. I have a partner of 29 years. They loved him dearly. And there was very little problem with stigmas. But the problem of coming out to my family was more my problem, not theirs.
Okay.
Just because I didn't want to tell them.
Sure.
If anything, they were upset that I didn't tell them sooner because it came as a total surprise.
Mm-hmm.
But their concern strictly was for my health and well-being.
Okay. It was known as the gay disease back in the 1980s, as far as I know.
Absolutely.
Did you take steps to correct perceptions of that?
Absolutely, yes. Yes.
Okay.
I still do to this day. You know, it's to educate, of how it spread, and especially the demographics clearly show now that, IVDUs, heterosexuals, it's universal. And you don't have to be a bad person, and you don't have to be a dirty person to get HIV.
Mm-hmm.
I always have wanted to write a book, but I never had time, and I probably forgot most of the good stories. But I had one young kid, a 19-year-old, 3 years ago. Matter of fact, he played tennis on University of Detroit tennis team back then, and only had one sexual encounter in his life. And I didn't know that he was gay yet. I was his family doctor taking care of his diabetes. And we called him to come in once only because I needed a wellness exam on him. For his insurance, we have to get a number, percentage of our patients get annual physicals.
Oh,
so we called him in to come in, and I talked to him and I said, I want to get an HIV test on you. You know, it's part of this wellness exam. He goes, no, I'm not sexually active. I haven't been, don't need it. So, and denied being gay. Lo and behold, he was HIV positive. So I brought him back in and talked with him. And then he said he only had one sexual experience in his whole life and he became HIV positive.
Wow.
So, I mean, I've heard and seen all different stories over the years.
You don't have to go too deeply in this if you don't want to. How do you safely interact with victims then compared to now? Or is there obviously there's different prevention methods, but in the early days, how did you safely interact with people who were...
Me personally?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah. I could tell you very clearly, I do the exact same thing in 2017 as I did in 1980.
Okay.
It's called universal precautions. Mm-hmm. I never gloved up, I never gowned up, I never wore masks unless I was doing a surgical procedure, and I would do it on anybody. And when I've lectured and when I talk to other doctors, I always tell them it's easier and safer for me because I know I'm dealing with an HIV patient and I'm always practicing universal precautions. It's those people that you're seeing somebody, you don't know that they may be HIV positive if you let your guard down and you don't think about it and something happens.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm doing things the exact same way now as I was then.
Very interesting. Do you feel that the overarching Detroit community is helping with you today with HIV prevention? Like, is there outreach or anything like that?
Outreach for HIV prevention?
Yeah, like, is there activism more like... how do I phrase the question? You feel that the Detroit community did all they could do to help HIV victims?
Well, let me preface by saying there's never enough.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Yep.
But with that said, I would say over the last 5 years, especially within the last 12 months, there has been a very, very accelerated rate of assistance in HIV prevention. The model has changed to, we like to, what we call test and treat, that anybody that's HIV positive gets treated right away. 2 years ago, we would wait till their sickness, by their CD4 count, went low below a certain level, either 350 or 500, depending on what year we're talking about,
mm-hmm.
before we treat them. Now we treat everybody irrespective of what their CD4 count is. And the reason we do that is because it's very difficult, if not impossible, to spread HIV if you're on therapy successfully and have an undetected viral load. So we really, really work hard at testing people and getting them on treatment, assuming they're wanting to go on treatment. And we try and convince them and educate them as to why they should be on treatment right away. So that's one big step. So I know that the Detroit Health Department is getting lots of grant money from the federal government. I just heard last week that Michigan received $1 million from the federal government just for HIV prevention. So we're seeing billboards now, and the health department's hired more people to be HIV prevention educators. We have, for those people that are HIV positive, we have something called EIS services, which stand for Early Intervention Services. So basically, any new patient that's diagnosed can get a counselor for the first 6 months to help them navigate through the system. It may be housing, it may be getting medical insurance, making sure they take their medication every day, perhaps substance abuse training. Anybody that's newly diagnosed can get this service for free for these EIS services. We also, probably for the last 10 years, maybe more, we have a case manager in this office through Matrix Human Services. They're here every day, a case manager. So if we have social issues that we're not equipped with, either with time or manpower to deal with these social issues with the patients, we've got somebody here on staff that can go meet with them on that. So we have come a long way.
So obviously there's a lot more resources for them today. Did they have a lot back in the 1980s when you were doing this initial?
They had nothing.
Nothing?
Nothing.
Nothing at all except for you and your practice.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
Much
easier now.
Yeah.
Much easier.
You said you've been treating some of these patients for 20 years, so you've kept in touch.
Oh, I've been treating some of these. I probably got about 15 or 20 patients that I've been treating since 1980.
Mm-hmm.
And they're my cherished ones.
Right.
I mean, without a doubt.
Obviously, since you're an HIV specialist, you still treat a number of patients. How do the numbers compare, do you think?
We're probably treating more HIV patients now than we ever have. We're probably just right around 1,000 patients.
Okay.
I also do a lot of clinical research on HIV. We're running about 14 different trials right now with new medications. And we're also doing one very large HIV prevention trial for those people that are high risk but negative, putting them on chemoprophylaxis and then monitoring them to see how many of them are getting HIV over a course of 3 years,
okay.
That study is. So I have a very interesting practice. It's very, very eclectic.
Mm-hmm.
I still have part of my dream of having a regular family medicine practice in the Berkeley community and take care of community members. I have a lot of gay and transgender individuals that come here. They know it's a safe zone that they can come to. And somehow, everything really meshes with each other. The practice is flourishing and doing well. I've had some patients that I've known for years that have come to me and say, I don't want to come here anymore because you're taking care of HIV patients.
Mm-hmm.
And it hurts a little bit, but I appreciate the fact that they're honest to tell me that,
sure,
rather than just not come back. And then I have some patients, very surprising, that I wouldn't expect to hear it from, that come to me and say, you know, here I've got an extra wheelchair, or I've got some extra supplies, and I know you take care of a lot of HIV patients here, and I had a nephew or somebody's HIV positive, and God bless you for doing it, and here's a wheelchair, if any of your patients needs it, give it to them. So I've seen both sides of the mm-hmm. spectrum as far as that as well.
So this is just ignorance on my part. What is the difference between this practice then and your goal of a family practice?
I'm exactly where I want to be.
Okay.
I changed my goal.
Okay.
I'm very excited because being an HIV specialist and doing it as long as I am, I'm at the cutting edge of medicine.
Sure.
I'm doing research. I'm getting drugs for people that have helped them more so in the past than now, but still even now, that I've been able to get them drugs that aren't even approved yet and get them on, and I've saved their lives doing it. So I love being on the cutting edge of medicine with HIV. I don't want to sound arrogant by any way, shape, or form, but there's very few providers that have the experience or HIV knowledge that I have.
Mm-hmm.
I've been doing this for close to 40 years. I go to all major conferences. I mean, I could talk HIV to anybody. I don't care how smart they are and know my stuff. Yet I still have the regular general practice of people coming into me for their blood pressure, their diabetes, their colon cancer screens or whatever. So I've got the best of both worlds.
Okay.
I'm primary care and take care of families, and I don't get bored that all I'm doing is just taking care of HIV.
Okay.
So I love it. I'm
yeah.
right where I want to be.
I saw on your CV that you still do a lot of research. Like you said, go a lot of the conferences and stuff.
Yes.
How do you balance that and practicing?
A number of years I was solo. I hired a couple physicians in and there, and they didn't work out for various reasons, or learned from me and then thanked me and went off on their own.
Sure.
Okay. And that happens. I have a very good team that works for me right now that I'm really blessed for. I have particularly a physician assistant that's been with me for 6 years. I took him, right out of his training, and he's become my right arm, which helps a great deal. I've got a nurse practitioner that's very good. I've got another PA working to look for another doctor. My plan now is, I'm 64 years old. I work very, very, very hard with very, very long hours. And my plan is really, I'd like to bring another physician or probably physicians, because I think it would be hard for one doc to do everything that I do.
Mm-hmm.
And gradually start slowing down and phasing out. So I'm actively in that process now. It doesn't seem to be working well for me. It just doesn't seem to be working well. But that's really what I envision for the future of the practice.
Okay. I don't have any more questions on my sheet, but
you were easy.
Yeah.
Did I cover it? I mean, this is the kind of stuff you
yes,
wanted to hear?
Yes.
Okay.
Basically, what your thoughts were when HIV was becoming like a mainstream thing that people were talking about, and then compared to now, and what your thoughts were, in those 30, 40 years. So I think we covered a lot of.
Yeah, I think we hit your focus points pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to think if there's anything else I can add. I don't really think so.
Mm-hmm.
Except, again, the metamorphosis that I started out as being a not respected, dirty, clandestine
sure.
doctor,
mm-hmm.
to now I'm, very well accepted with a good reputation. And I'm talking amongst the medical community.
Right, right.
We still have a ways to go. I gave a lecture about 3 weeks ago at the Michigan State Medical Society. And it was to general practitioners, and I was talking about HIV prevention. And somebody left me a note on the table that says, if you want to get rid of HIV, just get rid of the gays. I didn't like seeing that.
No.
And I have that piece of paper, too. And sometimes when I lecture, I always like to throw the hook out there first for my audience before I get into the didactical part of it.
Mm-hmm.
And, I've used that slip of paper as well. So as much as so much stigma is gone and we're doing so much better, we still got work to do.
Right. Do you think the stigma is still there? Well, of course it's still there for HIV-positive people. Like, I know people would kind of hide that they had HIV.
They still do.
They still do? Okay.
They still do. Not with the same numbers, but they still do.
Okay. Is that just because people are still unaware of?
I think it's they're aware of the stigma, even
right.
though it's less. They just don't want people to know. I've noticed that I think the gay community has gotten very, very far for itself in the last 30 years, without question. I see that now starting to happen to the transgender community. Transgender community used to be swept under the rugs. Physicians wouldn't deal with it. They were very, very closeted. And whether now because there's TV programs with transgender in it, I'm not sure what all the reasons are. But they're now opening up, and there's much less stigma but, with transgender. And our practice is flourishing with new transgender individuals coming in to help with their transitioning. And I see that much more now than I ever have in the past. And I equate it to how it was with the gay movement, you know, back in the 1970s and the 1980s.
Okay. Well, I think that's probably a good spot to end then. I want to...
Wonderful.
Thank you very much for your time.
My pleasure. If something else pressing comes out, you can always feel free to call
okay.
and email me as well. So what is going to happen with this interview that we just did?
This interview that we're doing right now, I will transcribe it for the Walter P. Reuther Library, which is the university archives at Wayne State. They will make it available as a oral history interview, and researchers can come in and either listen to the audio or the transcript and hopefully learn a little bit about the LGBTQ community and HIV during the 1980s compared to now. And
wonderful. Is it possible I can get a copy
yes,
of the
transcript? Absolutely.
Yep.
Once it's due for my class specifically on the 18th, but I can get it to you before then if there's anything you want omitted or anything
okay.
like that.
I don't think there is, but I'll sort of look it over. So is your job in doing this really just doing it and doing the transcript, or do you take this information and compile it in some way with other information and come out with some logical deductions or something? That's
my job specifically is just to gather the information and do the transcript. Future researchers could perhaps do what you just described.
Got it.
Because there's other people in this class who are interviewing people in the Detroit LGBTQ community.
Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily to do with HIV, but some are doing activists, some are doing other aspects of the community.
Sure.
So we're going to be gathering those and presenting them under the head of the LGBTQ Detroit collection for the Reuther Library, but it's up to the researchers to decide what to do with that information.
Sure. And the Reuther Library, is that anybody can go into, or do you need to be a Wayne State
nope,
student?
Nope, anyone can come in. We have people. I actually work at the library. We have people from all over. We actually had a gentleman over the summer who came from the United Kingdom to research in our archives. So,
wow.
The Reuther is home to the largest labor archives in the United States, so that's mostly what people come for, but we also have archives for Detroit in the surrounding area. So,
wow, maybe one time I'll go down there and crowds it.
Mm-hmm.
It sounds very, very interesting.
Yeah, the School of Medicine, I know, has their archives are being perused through right now because a gentleman's writing a book on the School of Medicine. So,
wow, very nice.
Mm-hmm.
Well, good luck to
thank you.
Thank you very much. It was a lot of fun.
Yep.
You took me down my own little road of history lane. I haven't thought about these things in ages.